Welcome to Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show with Maureen Howard. From making your own cleaning products to composting, recycling, keeping chooks and reducing your carbon footprint, Maureen and her guests will inspire you with practical, everyday solutions that make a difference. Eco Living in Action, proudly supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
Welcome to Eco Living in Action, the sustainable living show that focuses on the everyday things that we can do to make a difference. I'm Maureen Howard, a sustainability educator here in Dunedin. Well, this show, as you know, is supported by Sustainable Dunedin City, and news that they have for us at the moment is about to remind you about the Otago Access Radio survey that's coming out, so and that they would like to hear us give your feedback on what you think of the show. It takes just 2 minutes to complete, and you can do it on a little electronic questionnaire at surveymonkey.com/r/ZG7FNT2, or you can just go to the Sustainable Dunedin City and contact them and get on their mailing list, and you will find that out. And another thing, now tomorrow, 15th of October, we have Dr. Nikki Harry, who will be talking, giving a couple of workshops and talks. The first is from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m., and it's called Psychology for a Better World. And for those of you who don't know Nikki, she is an associate professor at the University of Auckland, where she does research and does a lot of, education around psychology and sustainability. And then at 5:30, there will be the she'll be talking about psychology, sustainability, and life as an infinite game. And both of these talks are in the Otago Polytechnic building. The one at 3:30 is in room G201, and the 5:30 one is in G106. Now, the first one is a little bit more focused on young people and the things that they can do. So university, polytechnic students, secondary school students, whereas the second one at 5:30 is for all of us. So go along there. Nikki is very inspiring and well worth the listen. Now, this December, I'm not sure if you might know about this. I've talked about it a few times, but I'm going to be going on a freighter to Panama as part of my journey to the Northern Hemisphere. And, you know, I'm getting excited about it and feeling a little bit intrepid. And one of the things that I'm most looking forward to is what wildlife I'm going to see while I'm on the ship, and what birds in particular, because New Zealand waters are home to a great variety of special bird life. So if, like me, you're looking forward to getting out on the ocean or travelling off the coast of New Zealand, this is an opportunity to, you know, familiarise yourself with what is out there in terms of our bird life. And if you've got an observant eye, you may be able to even contribute to science and record some of the birds that you see for the wider scientific community. So my show today is about the seabirds of the Southern Oceans. What species we're likely to see and what's special in our pelagic bird life and how we can assist with their protection. So Graham Lowe is a Department of Conservation Ranger, and both in and out of his paid work he has a great passion for wildlife and bird life, and he has led many conservation initiatives around protecting mohua or yellowhead, as you might know them, in the Catlins. And in his spare time, he studies a population of fairy prions that breeds off the cliffs at St. Clair. And in fact, this is the only mainland breeding fairy prion site in New Zealand. And Graham and an enthusiastic bunch of volunteers have actually recently completed a predator-proof fence around the cliff edge to further protect the birds and also to encourage other bird species to nest there. So it's a fantastic project, and they've actually created an entertaining and inspiring YouTube about it that I'm going to put a link to it up on my website once I get this show up in a couple of weeks. And so my website is ecolivinginactiondunedin.wordpress.com. So it'll be up there in the next few weeks. So recently I spoke to Graham about seabirds of the Southern Oceans. So Graham, you came to New Zealand many years ago from Australia, and I guess your passion is definitely wildlife. Has it always been that way?
Yes, I've always loved escaping from home and escaping from the city. I can remember plotting on a map, escaping from home by canoeing up the coast of Sydney.
But you didn't achieve it.
No, not achieved yet.
Still on your bucket list then.
I still love getting out to sea.
Yeah, right, okay. And so ever since you were a little boy, really, you've been out there. Okay. And so how long have you been with the Department of Conservation then?
Oh, I started with the Wildlife Service back in 81. I suppose going back to school was, on the way to school, there were sea eagles to be seen at the beach.
Really? Wow. Mm.
Yeah.
Like, were they quite a large eagle?
Yes, they were a large eagle.
Right, and so you were there. Were you quite scientific in those days?
I did write notes, and that's the primary thing to do, is have a notebook and write it down.
Right, okay, with the date and the time and the weather conditions. So lately, well, it's been quite exciting, your life at the moment lately, you know, like in terms of getting a predator-proof fence up for the fairy prions.
Yes, well, it's completed and it's been repaired and we've got the sound gear going. We called in sooty shearwaters last summer, but they didn't lay any eggs. This summer already, the sooty shearwaters are back. They're leaving droppings behind at the burrows we made for them, so we're hopeful they'll lay an egg. And this year, because we haven't had a rock go through the fence with the earthquake, we've put on the prion calls, and so hopefully the prions will be discovering the burrows we've made for them. The fence is just 8 metres up a sheer cliff from existing caves with fairy prions, so we're hopeful.
Yeah. So what has prevented the other seabirds from colonising this area? Because obviously the fairy prions have managed to get in there.
Well, yes, you could look out for diving petrels and things like that. It's a bit of a mystery why we don't have diving petrels more commonly here. They may well have been on Bird Island 100 years ago, just off Tomahawk Beach.
Right, but the fairy prions, they're a lovely little bird, aren't they?
They're very cute and very easy to handle and very easy to fall in love with.
Yeah.
They seem to know you once you've handled them, and sometimes they'll just sit in your open hand while you read their band.
Right, isn't that nice? It's quite a difference from the sooty shearwater. I remember volunteering with them. They're a bit more feisty.
They fight like their life depends on it, and the other problem with them is they do tend to abandon their nests if you handle them.
All right, okay. Whereas the fairy prions are quite different.
Yes, they tolerate our investigations. In fact, they even seem to do better.
And did you know that about them before you began that research?
No, we didn't know. I mean, people generally knew that they're a lot easier to handle. They're not as feisty as yellow-eyed penguins and other things that attack you with the fear in their heart that you'll kill them.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Quite, you know, different. You get differences in different species that way.
And individuals are different too. I thought I'd got used to handling some sooty shearwaters a while back, and then I got one that was even more vigorous than the rest.
Right. Did you have gloves on at the time?
No, but I had long sleeves, and I had those sleeves you put on for pruning roses, and I still got some scratches.
Yeah. But it's all important because it's, you know, to band them and, you know, weigh them and some of the things that you do with them?
That's the basic stuff, is finding out how long they live, who they mate with, how long it takes and the young ones to come back to the colony, because it takes several years. In fact, on average, about 5 years for a chick to come back to the colony and to successfully breed. We never see them for 2 years after they fly away at the end of January.
Right. So, obviously, you know, I'm going off on this freighter, and if people are heading off in their boats, you know, between now and, I guess, the end of the summer, like, what are they likely to see fairy prions?
Fairy prions are over the horizon, so going out in a boat's a good way to see them. You rarely see them from shore in the daytime. And way out at sea, of course, a lot of the seas are desert, but because we're astride of the Roaring Forties, we're at the meeting of the East Australia Current and the Southern Current, and in Otago we have the coldest water in New Zealand, there's a whole lot of turbulence happening which attracts seabird feeding.
So when you talk about that turbulence, it's bringing up food or I guess, you know, it's a richer marine environment where they can feed there.
It's the edges. So if you're doing your voyage across the ocean, keep an eye out for cloud patterns, because they quite often reflect temperature differences in the water. you know, cooler waters will have more clouds over them, and it's on the edge of the change where you'll have plankton meeting more nutritious water and everything feeding in a chain off that.
Right, okay. And what about the continental shelf? Will that be a factor as well?
It is a factor, and variation in it. So we have the canyons just 20 kilometres offshore here, and that's where you get into a different zone of seabirds. I've been able to observe seabirds every couple of months on the Polaris. When it does its water sampling, it goes out 64 kilometres east of Tairoa Head, and in that transition you pass from the very near shore of Tairoa Head to about 7 kilometres off, which seems to be a band of seabird area, 4 to 7 kilometres off. Then at 20 to 35 kilometres, you, over the turbulence that's created by the currents meeting the canyons, and the canyons are down at below 100 metres deep, and then you get right out into the ocean and you get other different birds again as well, like I'll see wandering albatross right out at the end of the transect and grey petrels out there.
Wow, it's exciting, isn't it? So, okay, let's leave the land at this point, and we're heading out. What are some of the birds that we'll see on, you know, in the more coastal areas?
Well, near shores, typically where the sooty shearwaters are most of the time, and you'll see some of their other members of the family. I haven't been out this month, so I don't know what's exactly happening at the moment, but of course the sooty shearwater migration has just come back and they're getting all fed so that they can lay their eggs. So we might see huge aggregations of them, or they might already be going down to the Ross Sea after having done some burrow cleaning. We'll see near shore, near the land, we'll see the Stewart Island shags, and we might see spotted shags anywhere. We'll see blue penguins and yellow-eyed penguins. And then when we get about 10 kilometres off, those sort of things drop out as the water gets deeper because they're bottom feeders, and about 10 kilometres off, getting around to 100 metres deep. All the time you'll probably have some Buller's mollymawks, and I use mollymawks for the small albatrosses. It's a New Zealand thing. It's an ancient Dutch-derived name.
So that's not used in other parts of the world, in the Northern
Hemisphere?
No longer. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Although probably the Dutch for an albatross is probably still mollymawk. But we are the world capital for all the tube-nosed seabirds, which includes the fairy pryors, the sooty shearwaters, and all the albatross. So just here, on an average day, on this transit, I'll see 7 species of albatross.
It's amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and I'll see about 20 different species of seabirds. Just going out on the Monarch, you should see at least 10 species of seabirds.
So, you know, one of the challenges really for people is, you know, and myself included, you know, just to be able to identify them. And it...
That's a real challenge. And you really have to get used to the common ones, and then you see a different one.
Okay, so what are some of the common ones so that we can get a good handle on them?
Well, red-billed gulls, start with that. Black-backed gulls. Black-backed gulls have several different colour forms as they grow old. It takes them 4 years to get their adult plumage. So this year's chicks are dark brown and fool everybody.
Yeah.
And they're quite big and they fly properly, but they're not albatrosses. And so, yeah, learn the basics and then you'll see the different ones. Of course, you'll see white-fronted terns, but we occasionally see some of the other terns. We're just coming to... In winter, we'll see the black-fronted tern, the rare tern that's now on the endangered list because its breeding habitat in braided rivers is afflicted by predators and by weeds and by having no water, which is going to be a big feature this coming summer. They migrate down to the coast and feed offshore in winter.
Right. So, you know, because New Zealand, it is very rich for seabirds, isn't it? And what is the state of our seabirds at the moment? Like, how are they doing?
Well, this list of about 20 species I regularly see, only 4 of them are not threatened.
Wow. Okay.
So there's only the black-backed gull, which has done well out of humans. It's not threatened. The spotted shag, which is really numerous still, it's not threatened. The gannet, which is in Australia and New Zealand, and it's got thousands, and it's not threatened. Then you may see a black-browed mollymawk, which also is not threatened. All the other seabirds, including your red-billed gull that everyone hates in the park because they squabble so much and have bad habits, they're actually declining rapidly, and they've got up into the endangered list.
I did read that recently, and I thought, wow, you know, because, yeah, you just see them everywhere. So, and is that a habitat issue for them too?
We think actually it's a climate change issue. There was a massive colony at Kaikoura, and the wind patterns have changed in that area. Instead of having more offshore winds, they've got more onshore winds. The onshore winds bring surface water, which isn't rich in food. You need the offshore winds, which take the surface water away and brings the upwellings, wind rich in food for the fish and the seabirds to live on close to land. The gulls don't fly far from land, unlike the albatrosses, which on their first flight, the Chicxulub head for the South American coast, 4,000 kilometres away.
It's amazing, isn't it? So we've talked about the shearwaters and
some gulls and some shags.
Yes, so it's quite good to kind of, you know, get them into their basic clusters, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of... on the terns, yes. And they're very pretty, aren't they? You know,
they're dainty.
Yeah.
And as well as the black-fronted tern, we sometimes get the white-winged black tern, which is basically an Indian Ocean tern, but it's colonising New Zealand and occasionally breeds here now. And we're seeing more and more of them.
Right. And what about the Cape Pigeon? Because I've seen it.
Oh, yeah, it's a lovely, friendly bird. It'll eat grated cheese.
So how do you feed it? Do you stick out your hand?
Not quite, but you can stick it on the end of your paddle and they'll come up.
Really?
I've been scuba diving and come up to the surface and they'll be swimming right around your head.
So what family do they belong to?
They're a tube-nosed seabird, so they're in the albatross family, or the family name, the common family name is petrels.
But they're quite a relatively small...
They're a little bit bigger than red-billed gulls.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So, and what about, you know, so are these birds, are we likely to see them in flocks? Or, you know, I guess that's one way that you might be able to distinguish
them. Well, that's
a
simple piece of data you can gather, whether you're getting just a few birds or you're seeing feeding aggregations or flocks of them. And that's something I particularly get enjoyment about, is seeing things happening, feeding aggregations and, things struggling with each other. Fur seals will go to the bottom, catch a fish, bring it to the surface. So mollymawks will be there waiting for the bits. So people wonder what happened, you know, how did they get by before fishermen started discarding offal? Well, that's how they got by, was by the discarded offal from fur seals. And then I've seen a bottlenose dolphin come along and steal the fish from the seal and the albatross.
And I guess then, therefore, their feeding habits are going to be a bit different, because obviously a fur seal is going to bring up much fewer fish than a trawling ship. And so you could imagine that, you know, perhaps the trawling ship perhaps encourages these large clusters.
There's been huge changes, even just in my lifetime. Sandy Bartle wrote 20 years ago about the first observations of a certain species following ships. So every now and then another species will learn to follow ships or follow fishing. But of course, there's now thousands of fur seals, so you can actually see how the ecosystem might have worked before humans arrived.
Right, okay.
And that's one of the fascinating things about New Zealand. One of the reasons why we do have so many seabirds still is because humans haven't been here quite long enough to kill them all.
Yeah. And hopefully, because we've arrived a bit later, we'll have the sense not to kill them all.
Yes, well, that's my aim in life.
Yeah.
To create safe areas for them, to encourage people to respect them, even the squabbling old red-billed gulls.
Yeah. So are you pretty excited about the Kermadec Islands and that big marine reserve that's been created?
That's a good thing, yes. And, of course, the really critical things that have been happening there in the bird world is the eradication of cats and rats on those islands, and that's making a big difference. But volcanism is a bit of a challenge.
Volcanoes, yes.
Yeah, they are active in the Kermadecs.
We can't really do a lot about that.
No.
So, you know, people can record these species. What kind of tools should we be using?
I find now the camera is actually better than your own eyes. So have a camera, single lens reflex one, so you can see what you're looking at, and 200 to 300 mil lens, and get practiced at taking shots. Put it in sport mode and go click, 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 click.
Right,
then
yeah.
Look at it on the computer and you might find out what you saw, because there's so great a variety of things that you really need to confirm what you've seen by a photograph. And there's some like the black petrel, the Westland petrel and the white chin petrel look essentially the same except for details that are less than a centimetre in size.
And this allows us, you know, as an amateur, to be able to say, well, look here, I've got the physical evidence, you know, rather than it just being our word. You know?
Well, even amateurs, I mean, you know, I've done hundreds of hours at sea and I'm always checking with Derek Onley about what we think this might be or that might be. Yeah. Derek Onley's a resident artist in Dunedin. He's done the artwork for the definitive seabird books.
Yeah, I've had him on the show.
Good.
For another thing. Yeah, he's great. So what camera do you use?
Well, I've just got an old EOS, which is quite light, and a 200mm zoom lens, which is at the bottom end of what you need, but because you're constantly moving at sea and these birds go past fast and you've got the camera hanging around your neck, you don't want a too big a lens.
Right.
So you might not get beautiful photos, but you'll get things that you won't see otherwise.
Right.
And so I just have the one strap, the camera on one end of the strap and the binoculars on the other end of the strap so I can change over quickly.
Yeah, and binoculars, same with the Forrester 8x40, is that
8x40 is good. You don't want too big a magnification. You want a big front lens to catch plenty of eye, to make light, to make your eyes work well. And even a 7 power is good because you're moving all the time. So you've got to point your binoculars in the right direction and stay pointed. And actually less magnification and more bigger lens at the front. And lightweight, so you can put up with having them with you all the time.
Mm.
And GPS to say where you are, because that makes a big difference. And you won't know otherwise.
Right. So we have them on our phones and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Some cameras have them.
I don't have a smarty pant phone.
The other
really simple thing I have, which everyone laughs at, is I have a bit of cream-coloured drain pipe around my wrist, which I can write on with pencil or pen. And so I can do the notes one-handed. It's waterproof. It's pretty indestructible. The trouble is I have a little sack of them that I've got to transcribe now.
And then you have to keep turning it around, do you?
That's easy, yeah.
That's a brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not maybe for me if I'm travelling and I need sort of small space. But I guess you can wash it clean maybe.
Yeah, just scrub it clean.
Yeah. And the behaviour of birds, we talked a little bit about it, you know, that I guess, you know, these ships, they do... Obviously, fishing ships alter the behaviour of birds. What about freighters and cruise ships? Do you think that they alter their behaviour?
Well, they're allowed to throw some waste overboard, and birds will follow for that reason. Birds will also follow, particularly the soaring birds like the albatross, just because the ship's creating an air wave that they can easily go from one place to another. And they've got great vision, and they've got a great sense of smell. And so they might just follow a ship, not because the ship provides food, but because the ship provides an easier ride.
Right.
And when they smell DMS, dimethyl sulfide, which is the smell of plankton, it's the smell of, if you smell a whale, that's what a whale smells like, because it smells like what it eats. That's what the birds are after. They know that there's plankton there, and therefore there'll be zooplankton there, therefore there'll be fish there, and they've got things to eat.
Right, and so they might get a little bit of food from the cruise ships.
Hmm.
Do the ships make a turbulence or anything? And
they're a big thing here, going through the wind,
But would they bring up a bit of food as well? Like,
they
do you think
possibly would, but that would depend a lot on what's happening with the water.
Yeah,
and of course, some birds like the sooty shearwaters, they can dive really well. Sooty shearwater is just remarkable. I mean, it can go from flying. It's got a migration that takes it right up to the Aleutian Islands in the North Pacific. It goes down to the Ross Sea to feed its young in New Zealand. And it can go from flying straight away to diving, using its wings as its propulsion underwater. And it can dive down to over 100 metres.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And what are they primarily feeding on?
They feed on zooplankton, so krill primarily. But probably anything that's small enough that fits.
Right. So we're going to have to finish soon, but now where should people get to go to get more information?
The Birds New Zealand website's really good. The library, of course, the Field Guide to Birds of New Zealand's a standard. The Te Papa website's got a great blog by Colin Miskelly about seabird wrecks.
Right, yes. And I guess, you know, you're always doing more things. Is anything that you want people to be doing this summer in terms of seabird protection?
Well, we're very concerned about the red-billed gull. It's nationally vulnerable now as its status. It's declining a lot. We want to know how many nests it has and where all the colonies are. So if you're out on the cliffs, count your seabirds, count your red-billed gull nests.
Great. Okay. And people can find out more about that, just identification at the Birds New Zealand website. Mm, so yeah. It's birdsnewzealand.org.nz. Well, thank you, Graham.
Okay.
It's great to have you on the show.
I'm jealous of your travels.
Yeah, I know, it's exciting. And that was my interview with Graham Lowe and about seabirds of the Southern Oceans. And you've been listening to Otago Eco Living in Action on Otago Access Radio, sponsored by Sustainable Dunedin City.
And pokes. It's then that you'll see the chips and the sawdust fly. Keep them logs rolling, boys, down to the mill, me boys. Keep them logs rolling down, for we'll drive the crosscuts through just to show what we can do. We'll pave all the streets of London town.
Community Access. Radio every way you want it on planetaudio.org.nz. Tired?